Do you like your coffee black, the way God intended it, so you could treasure the notes of each flavor? Yeah, that means none of that Jake Stone milk with a dab of coffee stuff. Well, if you do, our friends over at Virtue Coffee Company are offering 10% off your whole order if you use code LYCEUM2024, making an already affordable cup even more so. So if that's you, go on and check out their offerings over at virtuecoffeeco.com. There's a link in the show notes that'll take you directly there, and use code LYCEUM2024 and support a Christian coffee company. On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Matthew Baines about Gisbertus Fucius and divine participation. So we cover all sorts of topics like who is Fucius, why is he important, how does he relate to particular philosophical schools like Thomism and Scotism, and how eclectic really is the Reformed tradition? Is theology primarily practical or contemplative? Is there an element of mystical theology to this whole thing? What does it mean that Fucius' doctrine of God reflects the Neoplatonic belief that being is dynamic? What is the metaphysics of Exodus, one of the various senses of participation that we find in Fucius? Does union in Christ entail deification or theosis? Does Fucius allow for ontological participation? And a whole lot more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that is all about serious thinking for a serious church. And when I talk about serious thinking, I mean things like being kind and just in general. But when we talk about these sort of things, we've tried to encourage just sort of like a posture or an intellectual culture of things that value certain things. Things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So we think that coming to the task of theology or Christian history or different things like that, we should have certain intellectual virtues and dispositions. Those of kindness and interest in other people and what they say and why they say it, and not just dismissing everybody out of hand because, well, I don't see why they think that or I disagree with it. We would take the time to sort of unpack and understand why it is they think that way. But we also want to do these sort of thinking exercises with rigor. So we don't want to just give that up. We don't think that sort of a kind disposition means that we can't have critical interaction and feedback. And so we want to like model sort of both sides of these things, hopefully well, doing both aspects. Now, today I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Matthew Baines. We're going to be talking about a portion of his dissertation on Gisbertus Fucius and participation in God. So he's done a lot of work on this, and there's a ton of things that I'd love to ask him and talk to him about. We will not have the time to get there, but this will hopefully get you interested in these topics and cause you to think about some questions and hopefully get you reading more. So before we jump into the topic, Matt, can you tell me just a little bit about yourself, how you got started in thinking about Fucius? What was the main interest there? And then we can sort of jump into the topic.
Yeah. So I'm Matt. I'm married to Larissa. I have a couple of children. I grew up in a Christian home in Sydney, Australia. And I went to Bible college at Moore Theological College in Sydney, which is an evangelical Anglican university college in the tradition of people like Martin Lloyd-Jones and John Stott and J.I. Packer. I did a Bachelor of Divinity there, was ordained as a deacon in the Anglican Church of Australia, served as a pastor for 3.5 years, and then moved to Edinburgh, where I completed a Master of Theology by Research on Gisbertus Fucius's Doctrine of Divine Ideas. And then I moved on to my PhD on his Doctrine of Participation. That was supervised by Dr. Simon Burton and Dr. James Eglinton. And since finishing that in December, I've come back to Sydney, Australia, where I'm currently serving as adjunct faculty at Moore Theological College. So I'm Reformed, I'm Evangelical, I'm Anglican. I'm a huge admirer of this podcast, and it's a great honour to be here, Jordan. So thank you for inviting me to participate. I think in terms of Fucius, I think like a lot of people, I kind of fell into it. I was originally going to do a PhD on Francis Turretin. And I reverse engineered my master's and thought, well, it would help to look at one of his teachers for my master's thesis. And it was literally like going down a phone book and looking at different names of his teachers. And then Fucius was there, and my supervisor, Dr. Burton, said, I'll do Fucius. And so I did. And I fell in love with him doing my master's thesis. And then when it came to doing the PhD, I decided to kind of step to the side and instead of doing Turretin, do Fuchsius, which I'm very glad I did. And I guess I got onto the doctrine of participation because it's very topical, and it just seemed to tie together a lot of my interests in things like the doctrine of scripture, metaphysics, the relationship between God and the world, soteriology, all those sorts of things. So I kind of fell into it, but I've fallen more and more in love with Fuchsius and the Dutch Reformed tradition the more I've studied it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know James, so I've actually had the chance to hang out with him in person.
Oh, great.
Which is awesome. Really respect him. So anytime anybody's a student of his, I know I'm like, okay, then this person is going to be great too. Oh. So let's start with Fuchsius. Give me just a brief bio of him. Why is he important and relevant? You mentioned Turretin. What's the give me a little bit maybe more of the background, the relationship there.
Yeah, so Fuchsius lived and worked in the Dutch Republic. His grandfather and father actually died for the sake of the Dutch independence and for the Reformation cause. When Fuchsius was 8 years old, that's when his father died. And so we're talking, he was born in 1589, and so sort of just prior to 1600, we're talking, he grows up. Thanks to scholarships, is able to go to school and eventually the University of Leiden, where he studies theology, trains as a pastor. One of his teachers is Jacob Arminius. He then, once he graduates, he hopes to become a lecturer himself immediately, but that doesn't happen. And so he serves as a pastor in a couple of churches, one near his hometown, one in his hometown of Houston. He turns down a number of calls to other very prestigious churches in places like Rotterdam and Amsterdam. He does that for about 23 years. He gets a great reputation as a pastor, as a pamphleteer, and he gets embroiled in a lot of controversies, starting off with the Arminian controversy and then moving on to the Cartesian controversy with René Descartes and his followers, and then on to the Coxaean controversy with Johannes Coxaeus and his followers. So he's a controversialist, he's a pastor, and because of his reputation at the tender age of 29, he's invited to be one of the youngest delegates at the Synod of Dort, the third youngest delegate. And he's actually the last member of that synod to die, and he sees it as his special mission to protect its Calvinist legacy. So about 15 years after the synod, he's invited to become the inaugural professor of theology and Oriental languages at the then illustrious School of Utrecht. On account of his reputation, in part, that school is elevated to the status of a university in 1636. And then for the next 40 years after that, Fuchsius serves as professor there and also as part-time pastor in Utrecht. He has a prodigious body of work, a lot of it sadly untranslated. He marries a woman named Deliana van Diest, has 10 children with her, two of them going to become university lecturers in Utrecht. He just has a stellar body of work, and his legacy is not just in his written work, but in training a generation of pastors. He was working at a time during the 30 Years' War, when a lot of Protestants were fleeing from other countries to the Dutch Republic. They were getting trained up and then going back. And so Fuchsius has this unusual distinction of having hardly ever travelled anywhere, but his influence everywhere is enormous. Around the time that he's invited to become professor of theology, he does travel to England briefly, but that's it. He doesn't get to do the usual peregrination that you do after graduation. He hoped to do that. He hoped to visit the major centres of Reformed thought with a scholarship, and that didn't happen. But he kind of did that synthetically by bringing people to him and reading everything. And so much so that people often ask me, oh, did Fuchsius read this theologian or did he read this philosopher? And I usually go, yeah, probably. So his legacy was in his writings. It was in the people he trained, people like Francis Turretin, people like Petrus van Maastricht, who probably be more familiar to most people. He also trained people like Anna Maria von Schirmann, who was actually the first woman to study at university in Europe, which kind of challenges the suggestion that Fuchsius is sometimes perceived as this deeply sort of arch-conservative figure, but that kind of, you know, questions that a little bit. And he also had a profound influence moving forward. So you know, in turn, Maastricht would influence Jonathan Edwards, but also Fuchsius had a great influence on Neo-Calvinism, particularly Abraham Kuyper and Herman Bavinck. And so one of the great privileges of studying under James Eglinton has been working with his students and sort of comparing notes and seeing the lines of influence and dependence. So Fuchsius is sort of the most important person that nobody has ever heard of, which is ideal for a research subject. Sometimes it makes it hard to kind of connect with him and where he's at and relate him to, you know, everyday concerns. But he is actually a deeply, even though he's a big brain, he's a deeply practical thinker, and he deeply cares about the church.
You know, I've found him very impressive from the parts that I've been able to read. I mean, I can't read him in the original language, to my own shame, but I'll hang that on the hat that I'm a philosopher, so that I can somehow get out of that. But I think the first time I was introduced to him, I remember it was some of his works on like anti-Cartesianism and stuff. And I remember thinking, yes, this is the kind of guy I can get behind. And then I started getting into reading, you know, a section on divine simplicity, and I find him interacting with a significant number of sources. And it seems like he's very, very well and understood. And he's sort of comparing and contrasting these schools of Thomism and Scotism. And in the American context today, Scotism is very bad. It's the boogeyman under the bed. But no one's actually ever bothered to go read Scotus. So it seemed, even in there, Fuchsius is saying, like, the school of Scotism, Scotus, they're using different language, some different tools, but they're fine within this sort of orthodox orbit. How, in your mind, do you think these two sort of groups relate to each other, at least in his mind? And in your dissertation, you do a lot of work just sort of like the eclectic nature of the Reformed tradition. Is that really the case? Because a lot of people seem to say, no, that's not the case. There's sort of more of a monolithic approach to a lot of these issues.
Yeah, great questions. I would say probably Fuchsius finds himself in a similar position to people today who want to give Scotus more of a hearing, in that I think today, like back then, there is kind of a hegemony that Thomism has, not just in the Roman Catholic Church, but across the Protestant Church too. And that's for a number of reasons. But and so I think he also has to be quite delicate in how he broaches the two and how he tries to reconcile the two. And I think he's an open-minded thinker. He's someone who actually changes his mind on a number of topics. And he tells us that in his disputations, where he says, look, I used to think the Thomist view, but I've actually come round more to see the Scotist view, or at least I've come close to it. So he's a fairly kind of conciliatory thinker. He's a fairly harmonious thinker. And so in a sense, as a descriptive term, I think it could be helpful to call him eclectic. I guess my concern from a historiographical point of view is that I think the word eclectic can cover a multitude of sins. And I think in a way it can kind of prevent you from actually digging deeper and finding out what's really going on underneath the hood, if I can put it that way. So, for example, one of the moves that Scotism makes that doesn't get noticed a lot is that Scotism often tries to improve, correct, extend Thomism. So it's not merely opposed to Thomism. And you see this in Scotus's own works, where he actually says, well, let's take what, you know, Aquinas has done on something like analogy and actually extend it, or improve it, or shore it up. And so there's this sort of impulse where he says, we'll take this bit of Aquinas and we'll add this bit and it will kind of work. Now, that makes it tricky for historians of theology, because we can be reading through, you know, someone who uses Scotus and go, oh, here are all of these Thomist elements. He must be a Thomist. But actually, for a lot of Scotists, including Scotus himself, there is this drive to try and reconcile irreconcilable truth, apparently irreconcilable truths, and bring them together and make sense of them. And I think one of the things I worry about historians of theology today is they look at, you know, texts by different people like Fuchsius and go, oh, there's an analogy of being. He must be a Thomist. And, you know, Scotus had the analogy of being too. It's just that he undergirded it with a univocal concept of being. So I guess I would say to people in our field, just be careful of jumping too quickly to the conclusion that so-and-so is Thomist, and push a bit deeper and see what's kind of really going on. So I think that harmonizing impulse is really important for Fuchsius himself, but also actually for the Scotus tradition. So I guess I would say, yeah, okay, as an eclectic, you know, as a descriptive term, the word eclectic is fine. It's not very helpful as an investigative tool, in my opinion.
Very helpful. So one thing I'd like you to cash out for me a little bit that I guess I don't know why I've never seen this. Maybe I have, and I just have overlooked it. But you argue or explain that Fuchsius sort of has like three books when yes. it comes to just, I guess you have the Book of Nature, the book of Revelation, whatever you want to call it. I can't remember the exact term, but then you have the third book of like consciousness or something.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, the Book of the Mind. Yeah.
Yeah. So explain to me what's going on there. Is that unique to him? And if it is, or if it's not, like, I mean, what's the impulse there to do that?
Yeah. Great. Great question. So the two book metaphor you see in people like Augustine. So he'll talk about the Book of Scripture and the Book of Nature. Very quickly, it gets developed into a three-book metaphor. So examples of that are Hugh of St. Victor, who was in the 12th century. He talks about three books, Scripture, Nature, and the Mind. You also see Bonaventure using the three books. And you also see in the sort of Renaissance period, the mystical theologians, Ramond of Sabunda and Nicholas of Cusa, using that as well. So I want to draw attention to the threefold book metaphor because part of what I'm trying to do is locate Fuchsius both within the Franciscan tradition, but also to show how he's influenced by what we would call mystical traditions. Now, somebody who's written a couple of great pieces on the book metaphor is Peter Pavlas. So he's got an article in Reformation Renaissance Review. There's an article in a book edited by my supervisor, Simon Burton, called Nicholas of Cusa and the Making of the Early Modern World. And he does a great job of showing how this metaphor is taken up in the Reformed tradition and afterwards. So, I mean, all the metaphor is really trying to do is say that there's stuff that we can learn from Scripture, there's stuff that we can learn from nature, there's stuff that we can learn because in some way it arises in our own mind. And these three sources of truth are in harmony and they're not fighting against each other. I've tried to show that Fuchsius uses something like that. He's not one of the challenges with Fuchsius is that he doesn't produce a systematic theology. And so he doesn't tell you point by point, this is what I'm doing. So you have to go looking for this stuff. So some of it's implicit and some of it's not as clear as I would have liked to have been, you know, doing a PhD on it. You know, other people are using this metaphor. So Jan Amos Comenius, the famous Czech polymath, who actually overlapped roughly with Fuchsius and actually they knew each other. Fuchsius read his work and Comenius actually spent some time in exile in the Dutch Republic. So he's using it. One of Fuchsius's influences, a guy called Johannes Heinrich Ohlsted, another polymath, he takes that threefold metaphor and makes it a fivefold metaphor. So he's got the Book of Providence, the Book of Scripture, the Book of Judgment, the Book of Life, and the Book of Nature. So you don't have to just have it in that threefold form, but it does seem to be a trope that has a long history before the Reformation and is used by a lot of Reformed thinkers.
So another question that I have related to the topic overall is just you explain this concept of the metaphysics of Exodus, and I'd be love to hear what that means and what the various senses of just participation are, and how so that I can understand a little bit how Fuchsius is mapping on to that in general.
Yeah, so the metaphysics of Exodus is a metaphysical approach that's adopted by a lot of scholastic thinkers. And typically it's associated with someone like Aquinas. Now, how it goes is you look at Exodus 3:14, where God introduces his name for the first time in the Bible, I am who I am. And from that verse, you can construct a metaphysic and a doctrine of participation. So from this verse, you can argue that God and his essence is identical with his existence. Whereas for creatures, there is a distinction between essence and existence, such that creatures participate in God for their essence and for their existence. So that's basically where it comes from. And it's something that's actually widespread in medieval scholasticism. Because of its links with the idea of participation, it's typically associated with Aquinas, but Bonaventure has it. This is something that Etienne Gilson points out very well in his published version of the Gifford Lectures, The Spirit of Medieval Philosophy. But somebody he also points to who has a metaphysics of Exodus is John Duns Scotus. And he actually says that for Scotus, there's no better expression of the true method of Christian philosophy and the Augustinian Anselmic quest of faith-seeking understanding than Scotus's, which is quite a striking statement, because Gilson is known for his antipathy towards Scotus, especially in his later book on Scotism. But in his earlier book on medieval philosophy, he includes a quote from Scotus's treatise on the first principle. And I just want to read this out to you, because it gives you a real sense of what's under the hood in Scotus's system. So let me read it out to you. And it's in the form of a prayer, kind of like, you know, Augustine or Anselm. O Lord, our God, true teacher that you are, when Moses, your servant, asked for your name that he might proclaim it to the children of Israel, you, knowing the minds of mortals could grasp of you, replied, I am who I am, thus disclosing your blessed name. You are truly what it means to be. You are the whole of what it means to exist. This, if it be possible for me, I should like to know by way of demonstration. Help me then, O Lord, as I investigate how much our natural reason can learn about the true being which you are, if we begin with the being which you have predicated of yourself. That's not the kind of thing people are expecting to hear when they read Scotus, but it's at the start of the mature expression of his metaphysical system. Now, just by way of advertising, Thomas Ward, who contributed to the recent edition of the Hanover Journal, he's about to publish a new translation and commentary on this treatise. And so I highly recommend it to you. Everything I've read by Thomas Ward has been brilliant. So pick that up if you want to kind of get under the hood of Scotus's system. But what I argue in my thesis, and I'm really just following people like Cornelis Fabro and others. Fabro famously challenged Gilson, because Gilson didn't like Plato very much, didn't like the idea of participation very much. And Fabro and Geiger, following him, said, well, actually, participation, and which is a Platonic theory, has a very important place in Aquinas' system. And so they kind of filled in that gap in Gilson's earlier work. And Fabro brings out a few different kinds of participation. Now, you could parse these different ways, but there are kind of three that you need to know about. There's what he calls the sort of horizontal participation. So this is the distinction between essence and existence. It's how you relate the essence of a thing to whatever makes it individual. So that's the horizontal dimension. Then you have the vertical dimension, which is about how the essence reflects God. And this is where ideas of analogy and univocity come in. So you've got the horizontal, the vertical, and then a third kind, which is called transcendental or causal participation. And this is just the idea that creaturely effects participate in God as their first cause. So you've got your threefold causality here, efficient, exemplar, and final cause. You don't have material causality, of course, because there's that creator-creature distinction. So from the metaphysics of Exodus, you can derive at least these three kinds of participation. There are more, but this is kind of a helpful summary of what's going on.
Yeah, no, that's definitely helpful. So there's several aspects of this that I think I'm interested in engaging to some degree. One of the most interesting, well, maybe there's two of them. So I'm going to start with this one. His account of union with Christ, does this entail some sort of deification or theosis? Because in my mind, this maps to the question of participation in general. So, I mean, does this theosis allow for some form of ontological participation? I mean, if it does, what does that even look like? Depending on who I talk to, I get very different answers on what theosis is. You know, you get some answers of, well, it's just a generic vanilla, you know, or like, I don't know, something that everybody would be fine with.
Yeah.
And then you talk to some others, you're like, whoa, wait, what are we talking about here? You're legit, like you're adding on divine attributes or something weird. So I'd love to hear this explained a little bit.
Yeah. So I think I'd very much agree with the episode of this podcast dealing with T.F. Torrance, with Luke Stamps and Chris Wisnicki, where they argue that, you know, theosis or deification is not such a weird concept. If you take it the way which I think it has been for much of Christianity in the West. So as far as I can tell, the only person, major figure, who argues that we actually participate ontologically in the divine essence, as far as I can tell, is Meister Eckhart. And even then, he was probably using hyperbole. And very quickly after he talked about this, this kind of idea was condemned. So as far as I can tell, looking at the major figures in the Middle Ages and afterwards, nobody understood theosis or deification that way, at least in the West. I don't really know about the East. But I think probably the best and most widespread understanding of theosis comes from Pseudo-Dionysius. So he says that theosis is the attaining of the likeness to God and union with him as far as it's possible. Now, if you take a definition like that, you know, most, if not all Christians, I think, could agree with that as a starting point. I guess what I would say is that even if you can kind of have that basic understanding of theosis or deification, you can still configure it slightly different ways with different emphases. So what I would say is that for somebody like Aquinas and his followers, there's much more emphasis on created grace, on things like the theological virtues, like the infusion of faith, hope, and love. Whereas for the Franciscans, they're not uninterested in that, but there's much more of an emphasis on uncreated grace, on God's direct action on the soul. And someone who's really good at this is Mitchell Kennard. He's written a fabulous book which discusses this, published very recently. But he shows that for Scotus, Scotus talks about God indwelling the soul as a kind of deification, as a quasi-deificata. I guess in my thesis, what I try to do is show Scotus can fit into this paradigm too, albeit with an emphasis on uncreated grace. And then Fuchsius, broadly speaking, fits in with this paradigm of theosis as assimilation, as union, but again with an emphasis on uncreated grace rather than the sort of instrumental use of habits in between. Fuchsius does actually raise this specific language and queries it. And I think he like a lot of people today, would say we need to be very careful about confusing God and creatures. But nonetheless, I think if you look at his theology as a whole, he would agree with this safer kind of theosis, if I can put it.
Yeah. So then when I think about the beatific vision, yeah, what is his concept or view there, and how does this differ, or how is this similar to just the sort of the Franciscan view on this in general?
Yeah. So, I mean, the beatific vision has been getting a lot of attention lately, particularly in the Reformed tradition, thanks to the work of people like Hans Borsma, Michael Allen, Andrew Davison. And it's really great because it is an important feature in the Reformed tradition. Maybe it doesn't get as much attention as we would like, and Fuchsius actually says as much in his own discussion of the topic. I think something that often gets lost in the discussion is that there's more than one way of approaching the beatific vision. So the more well-known way associated with Aquinas focuses on the idea of vision or contemplation. So the goal is to know God. The less well-known way associated with Franciscans like Bonaventure and Scotus focuses on the idea of happiness and divine embrace. So if you take the term beatific vision, Aquinas and his followers put emphasis on the vision, whereas the Franciscans put emphasis on the beatitude. And this reflects the basic, you know, difference in configuration. You know, the Aquinas is much more intellectualist and the Franciscans are much more voluntaristic. So just to summarize that, I think that in the debate about the beatific vision, we need to recognize that there's different ways of configuring it. Now, Fuchsius is really interesting on this point because, as Andreas Beck has shown, he actually changes his mind. He says, look, I used to not object to the Thomist approach. He recognizes certain problems with it, like, you know, literally seeing God would seem to breach that need to retain the creator-creature distinction. He recognizes certain problems with it. He wasn't opposed to it at first, but the more he looked into it, the more he appreciated the truth of the Franciscan approach. So he actually shifts, you know, changes his mind, and he does that on a number of issues. And that's one of the things I try and draw out in my thesis, that, you know, he's really reflecting deeply on this. And so, you know, I think when certain people say, you know, the Protestants don't have a doctrine of the beatific vision, I think in some cases we can go, well, maybe that person doesn't talk about it. But in other cases we can go, well, they do. Maybe it's just not the one that you think he should have.
Yeah. I've personally gone back and forth on what I think about it. And I'd love to hear, like, having read Fuchsius and others, are you convinced by his arguments? Do you think he's right? Or do you think someone else might be a better guide on the beatific vision?
I think, so the Franciscan approach to the beatific vision is driven by one of Augustine's fundamental insights, which is that you can't love what you don't know. And when you break that down, it suggests that there's knowing, but knowing is actually ultimately ordered to loving. And I think that, you know, that fits very well within the Franciscan emphasis on not so much theory, but practice and the practical application of theology, which is to unite us with God. One of the real virtues of the Franciscan approach is, I think, that because it culminates not so much in vision, there is vision, but it more culminates in embrace. It's a way of recognizing that there is a real union with God, but we still retain our distinctiveness. So I think it can avoid some of the potential, you know, pantheistic problems of the Thomist approach. And I think it fits overall with the tenor of theology being about practice and, mm-hmm. and the goal of theology being, you know, about love.
Yeah. So talk to me about that too. I meant to ask you this earlier and I've got sidetracked, but I'd love to hear you explain whether theology is practical or contemplative. Because, you know, to some degree, some people who I read, they're going to argue it's contemplative and others are going to say it's practical. And, you know, there's others who's kind of like, well, it's a mixture of the two, depending on what it is, or maybe there's a chief end of this. It's ultimately practical. When I've read those like Turretin and Fuchsius, it seems like theology for them is ultimately practical because it's ordered to worship of God. Am I thinking about that right?
Yes. So Fuchsius does this interesting move where he says that a science is defined by its goal. So if the goal is practical, the whole thing is practical. Now, I often have discussions with people who are students of Petrus van Maastricht because he seems to hedge a little bit more, that it's both theoretical and practical, probably more practical, but it's both. Whereas Fuchsius goes all in and says, no, it's entirely practical. And in that way, he follows the English Puritan, William Ames, but ultimately he actually follows Scotus. And again, this is not something that people typically appreciate with eggheads like Scotus or Fuchsius. These very theoretical thinkers are actually, they're driven by the need for every aspect of theology to be practical. And Andreas Beck actually brings this out in a really lovely way in his monograph on Fuchsius, where he, you know, at the end of a really long and detailed discussion of the Trinity, he says, look, Fuchsius says the point of this is to provoke wonder and delight and to raise you up to be with God. So even very, very technical kinds of theology are meant to serve that purpose. So Footsius goes all in and describes it as thoroughly practical.
Okay. And then what does it mean for theology to be mystical?
Yeah. So that's one of the parts of my thesis, is that I'm trying to tap Footsius, or connect him with traditions that have been described as mystical. Now, again, like the language of theosis or deification, a lot of people, particularly Reformed people, can be nervous about that kind of language. I should say that my thesis is really a source analysis. It's not like a cross-sectional analysis of a lot of Reformed people and comparing them with Footsius. I'm really focusing on the sources, so much so that I often feel more comfortable talking about Aquinas or Scotus than I do talking about Footsius and Tarleton and Owen, because I know them better. And all I'm trying to do by describing some of his influence as mystical is tap him into different theological traditions that have emerged. Now, the language of mysticism, people get nervous about it to some extent, because it often seems to emphasize subjective experience. And that has a lot to do with the influence of philosophers like William James, who've stressed that. But Bernard McGinn has recently shown that, in the West at least, when talking about mysticism, it makes much more sense to talk about enjoying God's presence. That's kind of what we mean. And one of the ways you can illustrate that is with Augustine, right? So Augustine could be considered a mystical theologian, but he only had two experiences that you could strictly call mystical, if you want to do that. But actually, the whole of his theology is oriented around enjoying God's presence. And so what I've tried to map in the introduction to my thesis is that in the wake of the early church, you kind of see different traditions which are trying to theologize, trying to speak about God, but recognize that there are limitations to the ordinary logical way of making affirmations about God. So one of the things you see is what you could call negative mysticism, which is saying, you know, like we could say positive things about God, like his goodness, his wisdom and love, but that doesn't really give you a sense of his transcendence. And so you use negative mysticism to say, well, God is not finite. You know, God is, he's not limited by time, space, whatever. So Cyril Dionysius initiated a big tradition which does that. Another approach which you could call mystical is actually by going, logic itself has certain limitations, especially when you're talking about the divine nature and the Trinity. And so what you need to do in a sense is kind of go beyond logic. And one of the things that you can do that with is emotion. Now, again, you can kind of see how that fits with this sort of Thomist-Franciscan divide, because emotion is a very important part in loving embrace of God for the Franciscans. So what happens is this tradition of affective mysticism comes up, which is not anti-intellectual. It's just recognizing the limits of logic. And so this becomes a big deal for people like Bernard of Clairvaux. And then what happens is these traditions merge. So people combine negative mysticism and affective mysticism. So Thomas Gallus is one of the Victorines, one of the famous people who did that. And then people like Bonaventure then take that and run with it. And so I argue that this combination of negative and affective mysticism becomes characteristic of the Franciscan tradition. And so if you see it in Footsius, you can kind of link him back to the Franciscan tradition. There's a couple of later traditions that you could call mystical. One of them in the Renaissance is the Devotio Moderna, pioneered by Giotto Ruta. Now, important representatives of that tradition include Thomas a Kempis, Denis the Carthusian, Nicholas of Cusa. Now, we know that Footsius, for him, after the Bible, the most important book was a Kempis's The Imitation of Christ. He read a chapter of that every day. After the Bible, that's the one he valued the most. And as people like Willem Opterhoff have shown, he was heavily influenced by a Kempis. I've shown in a recent journal article that he was also influenced by Nicholas of Cusa and Denis the Carthusian. And then after that, so that's the Devotio Moderna that impacted him. And then after that, you've got actually the tradition that he was the intellectual head of the tradition called the Nadara Reformatie, which is difficult to render in English, but it means something like further or second reformation, the attempt to take the first reformation and kind of broaden and widen its impact through all areas of society, politics, church. Now, that movement is a kind of mystical movement. Willem Teylink, one of its pioneers, was a very kind of mystically geared guy. And Fuchsius, if you like, gives it theological and philosophical underpinnings. So in a nutshell, by describing the influences of Fuchsius as to some degree mystical, I'm trying to link him to the Franciscan tradition, to the Devotio Moderna, and situate him within his own Nadara Reformatie.
Okay, that's very helpful. Because like you mentioned, you know, when American ears at least hear mystical, you think of something very different.
that is being used
in these technical senses. Yeah. So one other aspect that you mentioned in your dissertation or thesis is the relation, I guess, Fuchsius' doctrine of God reflecting to some degree some sort of Neoplatonic belief that being is dynamic.
Yeah.
What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so I think the person to read on this is a guy called Russell Friedman, who wrote a wonderful two-volume work, Intellectual Traditions at the Medieval University. And basically what he shows is that if you look at the Thomists and the Franciscans, how they configure their doctrine of God and the Trinity roughly parallels or draws inspiration from the Aristotelian and Platonic traditions. So for somebody like Aquinas, he's heavily influenced by Aristotle's emphasis on the stability and kind of static nature of ultimate reality. And so when you come to God and you need to constitute the divine persons, you need to distinguish them, the way that you can do that is by relations, because you can add a relation or talk about a relation in the divine and not compromise the divine simplicity. So Aquinas will say that how are the persons constituted, how are they distinguished? By their opposed relations. Paternity and filiation are what constitute the Father and the Son. Passive spiration are what constitute the Holy Spirit. For the Franciscans, however, they do recognize these opposed relations as playing some role, but only secondary to the what you could call emanations. So by some reason, the Son and the Spirit proceed from the divine essence in ways that are analogous to a word or a concept or to zeal. And these are, they use the language of emanations to describe it. And this, if you like, is what you hang your hat on when you're distinguishing the persons. And their critique of the Thomist approach is that, well, how can you have a relation if there's nothing there to relate? You've got to have an emanation first. Now, the other difference between Thomists and Franciscans is that the Thomists are much more reticent to speculate about the processions ad intra, whereas for the Franciscans, they are much more interested in showing how the processions ad intra correspond somehow to the processions ad extra. Now, they're very worried about things like divine simplicity. They're very worried about not introducing any necessitarianism into God. But nonetheless, they see that there's kind of a correspondence between the ad intra emanation of the Word and the Holy Spirit by zeal, and also the ad extra emanation of wisdom and love. It's quite complicated, but basically, for the Thomists, much less emphasis on what's going on within the Trinity, much more emphasis on what God is doing in the world. For the Franciscans, they want to show how the dynamism of being at the heart of God is then in a way reflected in creation. So you can see that there's a whole bunch of landmines you need to avoid here, because again, language of emanation we're quite nervous about. But you know, someone like Scotus will use that. If you look at his Quodlibet Questions, question 5, he'll talk about this. So it's a bit complicated, but there is a difference in approach which is driven by a different view of being.
Yeah. So one last thing I want to ask you a little bit about is Andrew Davison's work. So he's got that Cambridge University Press monograph on participation in God, sort of like a Thomistic account. I've had Andrew on the podcast, and Andrew's just delightful. So he gave me a tour of Cambridge one time, just fabulous person. Really, really enjoy him. I am curious how you think Fuchsius might interact with that contemporary Thomistic account. Do you think he potentially solved some issues that he would have seen in his day of what maybe there's some gaps in a Thomistic, more Thomistic account that seem to be solved here or not?
Yeah, I really appreciate Andrew Davison's book. I think it's fabulous. I think anybody interested in the topic of participation should read it. I heard his episode on the podcast. I just appreciate his conciliatory tone and his want to approach this harmoniously. And one of the things I really appreciate about his book is how much time he gives to Bonaventure. Because we talk about in our field the forgotten Bonaventure. Everyone wants to focus on Aquinas, Scotus, and Ockham, and Bonaventure kind of gets left out. I guess I would say I differ with Davison on a few points. Davison says that he gives central place to Aquinas because he views him as a clear master of the participatory perspective. Now, my thesis tries to show that there are different approaches to participation, and I think that the Franciscan approach culminating in Scotus in many ways is actually a thicker, more robust version of participation than the one offered by Aquinas. And so I guess there's just a methodological difference there. And I think too, a difference in ethos. I think a lot of scholars have noticed, as when we're talking about the Trinity, that Aquinas tends to prefer Aristotle and the Franciscans tend to prefer Plato. And so when you're talking about a Platonic doctrine like participation, to me, it makes more sense that you're going to find that in the Franciscan tradition. I would say that I more or less agree with Richard Cross, who also appeared on the London Lyceum. I agree with his review of Davison's work. It's a fine work. Its style is amiable. It's an incisive work. It brings out a number of details that I think are really good. I guess my query is that, as I've mentioned, he often compares Aquinas and Bonaventure favorably. But if what I'm arguing is right, then there are fundamental differences that distinguish them. And one thing I've noticed this is not just Davison, but the scholarship more broadly, is that people, they might love Aquinas, they'll warm to Bonaventure, but they don't really like Scotus. And I would say, well, if you like Bonaventure, you'll love Scotus. because Scotus is the perfecter of Bonaventure. Scotus actually takes Bonaventure's theology and philosophy and really undergirds it and gives it life. And I'm not the only one saying that. Pope Paul VI said that. John Paul II said that. So I think if you want to understand Bonaventure, you've got to understand and appreciate Scotus. So I would say I would want to see more of a clear delineation between the Thomist and Franciscan approaches. Mm.
Yeah, that's helpful. You know, it's hard to disagree with anything Richard says. Amazingly yes. Masterful of a number of things, and it's incredible. Yeah. And you mentioned Tom Ward's volume, the one that's coming out with Hackett. I'll make sure, if you're listening, to link to that so that you can get a copy of it. I've pre-ordered it myself at this time. I'm very excited. Tom has the greatest mustache in history. So if that means anything, then you should buy the book. So Matt, tell me before we end, like if people want to follow along with your work as you continue to do it in the future, do you have a website? Is there a place to go or an email or something that they can keep up with you on?
Yeah, so probably the best place to go is my website, my personal website. It's www.matthewbaines.net. So www.matthewbaines.net. My social media handles are all there as well. I haven't been very active because I've only just finished and I haven't had a lot to say. Yeah. So, but I would start with the website. You can find links to my work. You can also find links to a work published by my supervisor. I should point out that I'm very dependent on a lot of the research that he's done and how he's trying to reframe our understanding of the Reformed tradition. And so I've actually got a link to his work. So his book is called Rahmism and the Reformation of Method, the Franciscan Legacy in Early Modernity. And I've put a link to that on the website too. So
awesome.
It's just been published by Oxford University Press. The introduction is worth the price of the book.
Yeah, you sent me over the introduction. I don't know what the time zone is. It was, for me, it was this morning, and I was only able to look at the first couple of pages, but it looked very interesting to me. So I'm excited to dig into that at a future date to be able to catch up on all the cool scholarship that's going on. So, Matt, this has been awesome. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Everybody's been listening. What you need to do is go check out Matt's website, keep up with all the work there. We mentioned Tom's book. Oh, and Russell Friedman, I'll make sure to link to those books too. His little intro or like history of medieval Trinitarianism is just fantastic.
It's amazing. I think if you want a more accessible version, John Slotmaker has written a book that connects with the Reformed tradition. So maybe start with that and then tackle Friedman's much larger work.
I don't know anything about this book. What's the title of this?
So I'll just find it for you. So it's John Slotmaker, Trinitarian Theology in Medieval and Reformation Thought. It's by Palgrave Macmillan, published in 2020.
Okay, well, you're adding more books to my list. And the thing that I always remember about Palgrave is they're incredibly expensive, except for random dates throughout the year where they go on sale, and they're very, very affordable at that point. So I just monitor them to see when their sales happen. I think I got the small little book on being reformed from them. They were selling it for like $60, which is like 100 pages. There's no reason for that.
Wow.
And then randomly one day it was like $5. Okay, bye. Cool, Matt, this has been awesome. Thanks for doing this. Everybody's been listening. Thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.